Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you live, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to The Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. On air on The Farm Report every week, we talk about agriculture and food production. Off air, I am the executive director of the Heritage Radio Network, and we've got a jam-packed show for you today, so we're going to jump right in. We are on the line with Sarah Brito. Sarah is the executive director of Chefs Collaborative, and she's going to share with us a little bit more about the collaborative and a really exciting event that they have coming up. Sarah, thanks for jumping on a call.
Hi, Erin. Thanks so much for having me.
So you're calling in from Colorado, correct?
I am, Boulder, Colorado.
Awesome. So for folks who aren't familiar with the collaborative's work, maybe you can give us the quick rundown.
Sure. Chefs Collaborative is a national network of chefs and food professionals who care about sourcing, cooking, and serving better food and who want to create a better food system. I like to think of it truly as a community of people who care about our food. And whether you're a member of the collaborative or a donor or a friend, we're all working to inspire and educate and celebrate those chefs who truly care about how they source their food.
Awesome. Well, I have to say, I'm a huge fan and a member of the collaborative.
And thank you.
So, you know, in the Farm Report in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be kind of kicking off a short series looking at meat and meat production in anticipation of the Slow Food Meat Conference, which is going to be happening out in the Colorado area later this June. So I definitely was interested to see you guys have a really cool event happening here in New York City that has a meat focus. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about why you guys chose to focus on meat for your New York City event and how folks can learn a little bit more about that and maybe grab some tickets.
Sure. Well, I think producing and eating meat is really at the center of the conversation right now around sustainability. And chefs and food professionals are really powerful change agents in that the choices that they make around their menus, especially, have the power to transform much more than just food. So at the same time that meat is at the center of the conversation, there's a lot of confusion around the issues. And what do people need to know? What are the matters that really surround meat that will help chefs and the general public decide what they should be sourcing, cooking, and serving. So we're really excited about Meat Matters. It's at the Food Network Kitchen in Chelsea Market. And so it's a really rare opportunity to explore the Food Network Kitchen, to learn about the issues surrounding producing and eating meat, which includes vegetables and grains, I might add, and to mingle and connect with some of the leading change makers in the culinary world.
I know you guys have such a jam-packed, like, star-studded lineup. Can you give us some highlights on who's going to be cooking with you?
Absolutely. We're really excited that one of the founders of Chefs Collaborative, founding member Chef Rick Bayless of Frontera in Chicago, is going to be joining us. We're also really excited to have Chef Steven Strajewski of the renowned Cochon and Butcher and Pesh in New Orleans. And then, of course, you can't throw an event in New York without New Yorkers. We're really excited to have Chef Howard of Gramercy Tavern and Chef Bill Telepan of Telepan in New York, as well as others, and the support of Brooklyn brands like New York Distilling Company serving signature cocktails as well.
Awesome. Sarah, thank you so much for jumping on to give us a little bit of an update. And we'll definitely be in touch more as we continue this meat conversation. I know you're on the steering committee for the Slow Food event out in Colorado. So lots more to come on that. And appreciate you sharing some lowdown on the upcoming Meat Matters event.
Thanks so much. And if people want tickets, they can find them at chefscollaborative.org/meatmatters.
Awesome. Well, jumping right into the meat of our show, hearty har har, we are in the studio with a very special guest talking about another area that's been getting like a fair amount of news coverage and a topic that we've talked about a little bit on this show, which is bees and beekeeping. We're joined by Rodney Dow. Rodney is the chair of the development committee up at Glenwood, and he also is the CEO and president of the Dow Corporation. And prior to that, was a professor of agriculture at the State University of New York in Farmingdale. So definitely lots of interesting history there and lots of great bee talk buzz, if you will. Okay, I'm going to stop. Rodney, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Erin. Nice to be here.
Well, we connected via our work at Glenwood. I work with the team up there, sitting on their advisory council, and we got to chatting in a little reception about your great passion for bees and beekeeping, which will form the bulk of our show. But before we get there, maybe you can give folks a little bit of a background on Glenwood and who they are and their important work.
Glenwood's work is primarily we're focused in the Hudson Valley, and our tagline is we are working at keeping farming thriving in the Hudson Valley. And we have a number of programs that have been going on, keep farming. We also have the cider. We've really started the cider awareness in the Hudson Valley and Cider Week. And we continue work with apprenticing farmers, and our big project is that we have going is an incubator project. It's up in New Paltz, New York, and we're getting farmers, young farmers, started in farming.
That's awesome. I'm a big fan. We're actually going to be joined by your director of programming, Sarah Grady, a little bit later this month, so folks should definitely stay tuned for that episode. Well, what about bees and beekeeping? How did you gain entree to the world of bees?
Well, I'll try to make a quick story of it, but it goes back a long time ago. I was fortunate to be spending a lot of time with an incredible grandfather who was a true Renaissance man. And when he passed away, my life in many ways ended. And to my mother's credit, bless her heart, she got me involved in the 4-H. And from the 4-H, I got involved in entomology. And then I remembered my grandfather kept bees. And the next step was I ended up at a Suffolk County Beekeepers Association meeting, and I found a surrogate grandfather who volunteered to teach me about bees. His name was Ben Saponis. He arrived here in the United States after World War II. He was a commercial beekeeper in Lithuania. And the greatest thing that he bestowed upon me was he was a real old-world beekeeper. And I learned things from him, this is back in the 60s, when we're learning these things now, you see it written about. But these are old ways and how they kept bees and used natural ways to figure out what they're doing.
Well, yeah, no, it's interesting. It's like we talk about that a lot on this show, how there is a tendency these days to think that we've like invented and discovered everything. And, you know, often you come to find out that like not only is that not the case, but lots of people have been doing it for a really long time. Well, I know here at Roberta's, actually, they had a couple of hives up on the roof. And I was just chatting with Melissa, the gardener, and she said, you know, it was just too much for the neighborhood. So they're not going to do the bees again this year because people got a little too nervous and there was some kind of wonky press around it. You weren't afraid of bees as a young boy? Like you didn't have the fear factor wasn't an issue for you?
I never had a fear factor, but it's not fun getting stung. The first sting still hurts as much as the ones I get thousands of stings later. And that never happens. But it's a mindset that you have to adapt. And it's part of beekeeping. And when you work with them, you're careful about how you work with them, and you pick the time of the day and the weather. It all has an influence on how little you may not, how little, you sometimes never get stung at all. And I work on the bees. The only thing I wear is a veil. I use my hands, my bare hands. And even when I get stung, I know, I just go, oh, that, just take a deep breath and let it out and pass on. It doesn't last forever, this sting. But it's good for you. And it keeps you healthy, keeps your joints lubricated, and stimulates your metabolism.
Getting stung does?
Absolutely.
Oh, so some strategies for solving those ailments. It reminds me of the like beauty thing where they have like the leeches on your face, where you're kind of like, really? That's a thing?
Well, we have apiculture, and apiculture is using a lot of the things for the bees produce, which are tinctures, which is the propolis, royal jelly, pollen, and also including bee stings to lubricate the joints, and sometimes you can help people with arthritic shoulders and arms.
Wow.
To overcome that. Obviously, you have to test them, make sure they're not allergic. That's the one downside. And I just want to go back to what you're saying, the bees here got a little bad press. Unfortunately, people talk about bees, and they categorize everything, which is hornets and wasps, into the factor of calling them bees. Bees are nectar collectors. When they're outside the hive, they have no interest to sting you. They will not sting you. You either have to touch them and try to pick them up and handle them, which you wouldn't do, or step on them, which often happens when you have a lawn with white clover and kids are running around with bare feet, or young people, they step on them and they get stung. But outside the hive, they don't sting.
They're not. Well, that was funny. We were just watching the clip of President Obama in the Rose Garden reading Where the Wild Things Are to a group of kids, and a couple of bees started buzzing around, and the kids were really going crazy with panic. But obviously not the case with you. You were kind of introduced by a very kind of gentle and guiding hand. So maybe we should start with folks by talking a little bit through the beekeeping process. If maybe you were going to school me on how to get started and some things to think about, like where is there like a jumping off point in kind of thinking about bees and beekeeping?
Okay. At Glenwood, I've taught classes several times and each time I change them up in how I deliver the information. And I started a new one just this year, and it looks like I like the way it started out. We're doing a 3-part series. And we're talking about opening the hives up, and if you're getting to starting a hive, how to work with packaged bees or what they call nukes. There's two ways you can receive your bees, and how to get them off thriving and growing within the hive. Because the number one game with raising bees is keeping the population up. You want to help the bees build the population up because they have one bugaboo they have to fight, and that's the varroa mite.
The varroa mite?
Okay. It is what causes the major problem with colony collapse disorder in bees in this country. And the interesting part of it, we have a name for it. It's called PMS. That's parasitic mite syndrome. And what happens with these mites, if you let them get out of control in your hive, they weaken the hive because they suck the fluids out of the bees, the worker bees, the young bees. And basically, they take their immune system and bring it down. And it's just like if you were partying every night of the week and going out and not eating properly and not eating good food, and which happens and getting run down, you're mm-hmm. going to be susceptible to everything.
Right.
And the pathogens are always present in the hives and around the hives. And what happens, these bees start to collapse. But the amazing thing about it is what happens, you build up critical mass with the mites, and it actually triggers a reaction in the hive and they collapse as part of it. There's another thing with neonicotinoid oils, which is a pesticide, but that's a whole other story now. I won't go there. But to get started with bees, getting back to your question, I always say to people is, first of all, it's expensive. It costs you several hundred dollars if you want to get really started buying clothes, covering gear, all the tools you need, hives and material and so forth, and then buying the hives. Bees have gotten to be very expensive. You're talking around $120 to $160 a hive just to get the physical bees. So I always say, find somebody you can apprentice with.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest reason being, and let's go back to the stinging. It's great. The bees are incredibly interesting. You'll never stop learning about them. But what happens, you get out there and you get stung once, and they do hurt because the honeybee is one of the only bees that has a barb on its stinger. So when it stings you, it stays inside you. If you get stung by a yellow jacket, which everybody calls bees, they sting you multiple times. They can sting and pick it up and sting you again. And they're the aggressive ones that you see later in the season, in the summer, that people, when they get stung, they said, oh, it's those bees. And right. That's the bad rap they get. So I always say, get out there, work with somebody. You can cover yourself up really well, and you may go 6 months, a year, year and a half, but eventually you will be stung
right.
working with bees. So it's you either have to accept it. It's always, like I said, it's always painful, but that's the minimal price you pay.
Like the cost of doing business.
The cost of doing bees. And if it fits and you go to it like a fish to water, it's just move on. It's just wonderful. I mean, you just, because the knowledge that you can learn and the interest in things you can do with bees and eventually get honey from them, you can make your tinctures to keep you healthy. And I do that part in the classes that we do. And you end up with having a lifetime of learning.
Okay. So I, like post-apprenticeship, obviously in my imaginary Aaron Fairbanks beekeeping world, I have decided that like this is something I'm really into. So I'm looking at getting kind of gear, being like the clothing that you might want, which would include, I think we see from the movies, like the nets that go over your face and some type of like gloves or other protective stuff. And that sounds like there's a range there depending on like your level of comfort. Cause you said you just use the face mask.
Face mask. Yes, that's correct. Because when I don't want to get stung in the eye, that could be create a problem. The other thing is, if you ever get stung in your ear or in your nose, it is the most painful place to get stung.
Okay.
For some reason, it's, you know how you get, you bump your nose or
yes.
You feel
that.
The pain. Well, when you get stung there, you can kind of get what I'm talking about. What I recommend is get a veil. You can buy these whole outfits, and it's a lot of expense to
right.
get it started, which covers from head to toe, and boots and or wraps around your ankles to tuck that in. What I say to people is get a white long sleeve shirt.
Right.
White's a good color. Do not wear black around the bees. Bees do not like the black color.
Really?
Black. No. I sometimes think that they probably think it might be a bear. I don't know.
It's like a long evolutionary history.
And I never thought about that until one day I happened to go and wanted to look at one of my hives. I had absolutely nothing on, no veil, just, and I had a black t-shirt on. And I opened up the hive, and the hive just immediately just elevated into a kind of aggressive mode and pushed and jumped on me. And then I got a few stings from it.
So no black.
So you need a white shirt. And you need a veil, and the gloves that you can buy. Gloves, the best kind of ones that are made out of goat skin because they're flexible. Reason I do not wear gloves is that I can't get a good feel of bees, and when you're pulling out frames, and at times if I want to move a bee around, if I see the queen and I want to put her back into the hive, I'll just pick her up with my hand, like cradle her in her back and set it over and put her down.
That's an advanced move, guys. Don't be trying that.
That's correct. But so that's really what it is. Just start working with them. And this weekend I'll be working up at Glenwood. I haven't opened the hives yet. This is one of the most exciting times of the year because the whole point is to interpret the hive and read it. And that's a real good learning time. And I told everybody to bring some veils and some, if they want, wear gloves, or just keep your hands in the pocket and observe.
Okay. So I want to come back to that like seasonal component because I think that is like such an interesting part of the bee story. But before we move on from there, so once you're kind of physically geared out, the other kind of components to starting a hive is okay, the bees, which we'll come back to. But how do you build a home for the bees? I mean, can I go on like, you know, modernfarmer.com and buy a bee house? Like, what is the terminology and the like thing about creating the space for the actual bees?
That's a good question. Important thing is that in order to have your bees thrive, you have to have a good home. And first of all, you have to think about location. The best direction you're going to set your hive is south, the slightly southeast. Because what stimulates the bees to come out of the hive is temperature and sunlight. So you want to be focusing them in that direction. And you also want to have what I call a bee line. The bees come out of the hive and they go up and then take off. So, and that can extend out to 20 feet in front of the hive. So you need to have a good beehive. or beeline.
Beeline. And so that's where that word comes from.
That's where it comes from. It takes a beeline.
And, yeah.
And even a hedge in front of it out 10 or 15 feet is good because they won't fly through the hedge. They'll soar up and it'll go, you'll get them going straight up in the air. And then they'll disperse out to different directions. So there are a number of bee suppliers all over the country. You have Walter Kelly out of Kentucky, a very good operation. You have Brushy Mountain, which is down in the Carolinas. You have Bitter Bee, which is up in New York State. And you can also find, just slipped my mind, but I'll come back to it. But that's the primary ones that are out here to get the equipment. And you need to buy, if you call them up, most of them very helpfully, you need to start out with two supers, which are the boxes which contain 10 frames. Interesting thing about these beehives, they were developed and invented by Lorenzo Langstroth back in 1851. They have changed very little in that time, which is pretty amazing.
Well, that's like one of the things I was so fascinated to learn earlier this month. We had someone who runs a pollinator advocacy campaign on, and I had no idea that honeybees were not native to North America. That was like a big surprise. So like in the U.S. at least, in North America, the our beekeeping tradition goes back to when exactly? Do you know?
Yes, and that's a very good point. That is, very few people know that. I won't say very few, but there's a lot of people that do not know.
No, make me feel good.
So yeah, they came over with the pilgrims, and they brought them here, and they thrived. There were no varroa mites, and when I was a young kid, they would multiply. They'd swarm. I was catching swarms all the time. I got my list on the Cooperative Extension Service. I never had to buy bees. I had my name as a list, and I'd go out and grab swarms when they were up in trees, and I'd start a new colony, and it was really easy. And keeping that in mind, the bees can regenerate themselves, and I still continue to gather swarms to keeps the hives going. In fact, I try to keep recycling my bees and splitting them. There's a technique for splitting these bees. So I hope that...
Well, okay, so I want to come back to that too. Gosh, there's so much good stuff here.
Right.
We were talking about the boxes, which you called what again?
They're called supers. You need two large ones. But getting back to the suppliers, they can help you through this.
Yeah.
There's only one thing that's really important. They always try to give you plastic frames because you don't have to put them together. You don't have to make them. Mm-hmm. You just stick them in the hive. The unfortunate thing is bees don't really take well to them.
They don't like it.
And one of the things they have to do is they get these frames that have little hexagon indentations in the center of the frame, and they build out the cells. Mm-hmm. And they slow it doing it. They just do not like the plastic.
They don't like the plastic.
The ones I use and what most beekeepers will use are 100% beeswax.
Oh.
But you have to put these together, and it takes work. And this is where I go back to say, start with somebody and apprentice with somebody. And we are going to have a workshop where we're going to just make frames because it's important to have good frames to make a lot of bees.
Okay, so for folks who have never seen a super box, can you describe like the size and the dimensions?
Sure. It's about 9 inches by 11 3/4 inches. There are 10 what they call removable frames. They slide down in the slot, and they have a little hookup where they lay down, and that's the removable hive frames. Prior to that, the only thing they had was skeps, and they're the old pictures with a round head, oval straw, how can I describe it? They call them skeps, or straw skeps, or little mounds where they used to catch bees, and you'll see it in the old movies or old photos.
Okay.
That was the only way to catch get honey. And then what you do is you have them sitting on a flat stone or a piece of wood, and then you just turn the hive over and cut out a little bit of honey when you needed it. But you could never, you destroy the frame, you destroy the wax. With the removable hives, where you can go in, you can take the honey out, you can extract the honey, and put the frames back in, and the bees start filling it up again.
So in my head, it's like it kind of, when I think about it, looks like some kind of like large like filing system, essentially, where like the frame is like you're sticking like a file in, and you can completely remove that, and what you have there is the like whatever the building material of the frame was. So it sounds like it can be plastic or, or beeswax. And then that's where the bees actually build the honeycomb and where the honey is.
They take your frames, they pull out the combs, and in the center is where they'll have the brood, which is the baby bees being hatched. They're a complete metamorphosis. They go egg, larva, and pupa stage, and then they hatch out and sent to adult. And they have to maintain temperature inside the hive of the bees. They try to keep it right around 96.8.
Okay.
Our temperature is 98.6. Bees are 96.8. And they center the brooding chamber in the center of the hive where you get your honey is more on the outer frames. So there's 10 frames, and generally speaking, you'll have the two on the either left or right side. You'll have two frames that are predominantly all honey. When you're raising bees, as they build the population up and they're ready to expand, you just keep adding on supers, then you go to a next size, which is called a medium-sized super, which is easier to handle because you take a full large super, which is that square box, which is a use for breeding. You can make honey in them, but they weigh about 90 pounds, and it's a lot of weight to handle.
Yeah. All right, so we've got our gear, we've got our super, we've got our frames. And then the bees, you can actually order. I know you listed a couple of places. I actually, it was a number of years ago, brought a group of, a hive starter kit down to the city for a group, I think, who was working over at Just Food, which is like a social justice-oriented food organization here in the city, to start their hive. And it looked like, it was basically like a very thin rectangle box with screens on both sides full of bees that I'm no joke. I put it underneath my car seat. It was right behind me on the truck. And then every once in a while I'd pull it out and spritz it with a little water. But that was the bee delivery mechanism. Is that normal?
That's called package bees.
And
that is the most common way to move them around. And in part of this beginning class, I showed the easiest way to get these into your hive. That's kind of the fun part. To get them in there and be happy, and they have to release this queen. The queen's in a little package separately, but that's kind of the fun part, getting started and making sure everything is up and running. One thing I just want to jump back. The bees were brought here by the pilgrims, and they are not the most efficient pollinators. We have many natural pollinators. However, because they have an ability to build up the population in the springtime very rapidly, the massive number of bees that can be produced with honeybees compensates for their poor ability to pollinate plants.
Okay, so what they lack in efficiency, they make up for in volume.
Total volume. And, awesome. And that's why we have them here in this country.
Not to mention the honey, which we also like.
Oh, yes.
Well, we are going to take just a short break, and when we come back, we're going to kind of continue the bee talk. Where you're listening to the Farm Report. We're in the studio here with Rodney Dow. Hang tight. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Balloons by Jack Inslee. This is the Farm Report on heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
We are students at Girls Prep, and you're listening
We are back, continuing our bee talk with our resident bee expert, Rodney Dow, who is visiting us from the Hudson Valley. So we talked through in the first part of the show kind of some of the basic components of getting started with a bee project, a beehive.
What's the right
a beehive? Getting started with a beehive. So now we're there. Give us a sense, like, what is there like a time of year that makes sense to start and why? And then aside from making sure that we have a good like beeline for the bees when we think and like we're placing them in a way that's going to be nice and warm and cozy, what are other things that like bees like or don't like that we should be thinking about or that you think about when you're thinking about placement and getting a new hive going?
Well, the first thing is to start early and get your hive together. You can, it's amazing what you can find on YouTube and how to assemble these. They give you instructions. I don't know who writes the instructions sometimes, so we all kind of know that. But
YouTube with a grain of salt, always. Yeah,
I love YouTube to figure out something. And so look on YouTube. I would, if you can, look around for a beekeeper that's been doing it for quite a while. A little interesting thing about beekeepers, if you have a question and ask him, he will tell you that it's absolutely the only way to do it. And it's the same if you ask that same question to 100 other beekeepers.
Right.
So you have to, the beekeepers have been around a while. They're kind of pretty strong about what they think you should do it just this way.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's always one right answer, and I'm always looking to try new things and experiment to see if I can make things work just a little bit better. And I've been doing it for a very, very long time, and it's what keeps it really going and interesting. And sometimes you find new ways, and I worked on creating a new way to install a package hive of bees where you don't even have to shake the bees. You can do them in about 5 minutes. And so far, I have a 100% track record. And wow. I should really take the time to write an article on it, but I haven't yet. But it's a great way, but I love to show people how to do it because it's real easy and you don't have a lot of bees all over the place flying. So that's the one thing. So you get your started early, build your boxes. If you can find someone to help you build the frames, you should. If you start out with wax frames, you're going to be challenged, but I've seen hives that survive. But the name of the game is to get the population up if you can. And that's pretty much, then you get into the midsummer where you have anticipation, you want to do a way to check on mite counts. This is that little bugaboo that you have to maintain and how do you, and there's a number of ways to treat them and how do you find out what your count is, and it's an estimation game. And there again, you need help with somebody to do it. And then once you get going, you want to make sure that as you come into the fall, that you have enough honey. Oftentimes, people who want to start on bees, the first thing they say is, how much honey can I get out of it?
Right, right.
And I say, you don't get any honey out of them. It's about the bees. It's not about you getting honey out of them. Because first-year bees take a long time to get established. And if you have, and a lot has to do with the weather, the temperatures, a lot of rain, do we have a good nectar flow? And these will have an effect on the overall population and building up of honey in the hive over winter. So the first year, it's seldom I take honey from a new hive. I want to get them established and strong and thriving. That's our point. Then the next year, that's when you can crank out and make the honey. And it's techniques you have to do to help them stimulate their production. And you got to keep them from swarming, which you can do. But again, it's a lot of work. Working with bees is something that just clicks. And it's a lifelong passion because you can always learn something new. And also the thrill of just seeing those bees and getting into them and looking at them. And one of the things that I do when I go to a hive, the first thing I do is I say to people, before you go open a hive, you got to go and talk to your bees.
Okay.
So I get down by the entrance and I say, hi, girls, I'm here, because there's a lot of, they're all females in there and there's a few drones, but and I say, hey, how are you doing today? I'm coming in. I got to check a few things. I want to make sure everything is okay. And I won't stay too long. And I'm going to be careful. So, and then I look at apprentice. I love doing this with apprentice and say, see, when I watch this hive open it up, it'll be really calm. And they kind of look at me like this guy is, you know, not playing with a full deck. However, I said, then I kind of let him in on the secret. I said, they didn't understand a word I said to him. But what they did understand is me. They know me. They didn't feel any anxiousness to my voice, and I was close to the hive where my smell was waffling in, and I come there all the time. I also try to wear the same clothes when I work in the bees. And at the end of the season, my coveralls or my shirt I have sometimes looks pretty nasty, but I don't change it because they know that smell. And then I open up the hives, and I try not to use a lot of smoke. We have a little smoker that we use to control the bees. It kind of calms them. They start getting a little antsy and start to get a little nervous. You smoke them a little bit, and what happens? They think, oh, my God, there's a fire. And they run to a cell, and they immediately fill their stomach up with honey. And what that does is that they're fat and round, and they can't bend over. They have to arc their abdomen to sting you. So after they're filled up with food, it's like Thanksgiving dinner. You got too much food, you don't feel like, you know.
Right.
So it's the same thing. They fill up with honey, and they can't quite bend their tail. So you're going to have less bees stinging you. And so that's, you know, part of the fun. But I say to them, they know who I am. And if I have a group of people around me and the bees are coming out of the hive, you may have one person where the bees are flying around their head, and they're the nervous person in the group, because when you get nervous, you emit odors that the bees pick up, and they'll come and smell, check you out a little bit more.
Plus, I feel like you always see in movies that, like, the beekeepers are always kind of portrayed as these kind of almost guru-esque figures of, like, calm and meditative, like, you know, presence, and that is because, like, you have to be chill to keep the bees chill, basically.
And I think that's even part of the fun, is you're absolutely correct about that. And one of the things that I talk about is that beekeeping is an art form. If you're a commercial beekeeper, you cover yourself from head to toe, you wear leather gloves, and you bing, bang, boom, you're killing bees, squashing bees, but it's a numbers game, you're too busy, and they don't have any, it's that inner passion for these it's strictly money-driven. In the commercial, keeper of bees side of this, where people who want to start out and keep their own bees, and some people may want to go into little production for themselves, but you can work with them. You work with them slowly. You work on them gently. And, you know, like I want to put on my note that I sent on my bee blast for this weekend, is I said, just bring a veil. And people asked me a few more questions. I got some feedback, and I said, If it's calm, the weather's good, and the bees are happy, you don't have to worry about a thing.
Right.
Because there's many times I work on them, bare hands, all day long, and I never get stung. And I also work with a variety of bees that are somewhat more gentle.
More gentle.
But the main thing is you go in, you calm them down, you talk to them, you take your time, you think what you're doing, and just handle them gently, and they will treat you nicely. Also, the ones that sting you the most are the adult bees that are the nectar collectors, the one that goes out in the field and gets pollen and goes out and gets the nectar to make into honey. And they're out foraging during the day, so it's best to go out right around midday when the sun's warm and they're all out of the hive. You decrease your population by at least a third while they're out there gathering, so you not have to deal with them. So it's very important about timing. No wind, no rain.
Right.
No chill.
Nothing to, like, aggravate them. Yeah. Well, and then so timing, it sounds like here in the Northeast, if you're either starting a hive or, as you mentioned earlier, waking up a hive, that kind of happens in the spring?
Yes. We try to start it right around April. That's the best time to do it because we're having a very late season this year. I haven't even packaged my hives and unwrapped them. I put them away for the winter. Normally, I'm done in March, and here we are almost coming into the middle of April, and hopefully this weekend it's going to warm up, and we'll get in on them. So that's when you get them started. In this midsummer, you're going to check for swarms and mite counts, and then I start in September. End of August, getting ready for winter, making sure they have enough honey in the hive. If they don't, I will artificially feed them sugar water. A lot of people use high fructose corn syrup, which would be something I would never do. You can buy that. Commercial beekeepers use high fructose corn syrup. But no, I use just regular white sugar and to dilute it 50-50 with water. So
like quarter simple syrup
sugar.
For bees.
Yeah, simple sugar. And I feed them. I have a very interesting technique to do it, very different than anybody has ever seen. I do it real quickly. And I do actually 5 gallons at a time.
Oh, wow.
And a hive that's reasonably strong, they can consume that and get it into the hive in about 5 to 6 days, which is pretty amazing. And the next thing is, do they ripen it? Now, when I say ripen it, what they have to do, when they put that nectar in those cells, they have to dehumidify the hive. And the way they do it is by fanning with their wings. And they have to dry it out because they have to raise the viscosity of the nectar to become honey. Because of it, and then when the viscosity is correct and they know this is it, they cap over the end of the cell. And that's very important, because if it's what I call green honey, where it hasn't been capped over, and you go and extract that, that will ferment on you. And that naturally is how one of the most wonderful things were ever found was mead. It's because green honey got fermented. And had a wonderful drinking of the first alcohols in the world.
So green honey is basically, just to clarify, it's basically honey that hasn't kind of dehydrated enough, essentially. So the like water to sugar. I mean, it would be like your Brix ratio. Is that what you?
That is correct, and okay. the viscosity gets high enough. That's exactly correct. And honey is the only natural food that never spoils. Now you can have it around for 10 years, and you take it out, it'll be very dark, and it might have a little bit of a bitter taste, but it's not poisonous or it won't get you sick.
Yeah,
which is pretty amazing. That's why it works so well in embalming.
In the what?
They embalmed the Egyptians.
Oh, right. The Egyptians, when they like found the honey. Yes.
Yeah. So.
Well, I remember when I was a kid, my mother's father, my grandpa, kept bees. And sadly, he passed when I was 10, so I didn't have a lot of memories of that time. But like, I remember like walking out to look at the hives. For me, it was from a distance. But we always had like a giant jar of honey, you know, like a 2-gallon jar of honey, like in the cupboard at my house, that would like, you know, change form throughout, because it was around for a long time.
Right. Well, one of the things that happens is that naturally, as it sits, it starts to crystallize. And oftentimes people think, oh, it's crystallized. It starts to get funky in the bottom, and it's really just crystallization happening. And then they throw it out. There's nothing wrong with it.
Well, it'll change color. So
and it starts to get changing colors. Most importantly, don't put your honey in the refrigerator, because it accelerates crystallization. So put it in your cupboard. It won't spoil.
So what about when you buy honey, especially if you buy honey from like a more boutique-y establishment, you know, it'll often be designated by season. It'll be spring honey I feel like I usually see spring honey or fall honey.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like, I guess it's kind of a two-part question. What I'm wondering is if you're raising bees in the Northeast, you know, you're impacted by the seasons where you essentially like hibernate the hives. But if I'm raising bees in Florida per se, they never go into hibernation, or?
They slow down. They in cooling periods of time they will, but they'll come more year round. That's why most all the package bees come out of the South, up all the way up into Georgia, because they can produce bees for a much longer period of time. What happens with the bees, people say, well, do they hibernate? Well, they don't hibernate in the wintertime. What they go to is cluster. They pull in very, very, very tight, queens in the center. And they just rove around through the hive. And as they go through the hive, the ones that are chilled on the outside roll into the middle, and the ones in the middle keep coming up. And they do it in ultra slow motion. And that's why bees. But getting back to the honey, when you buy honey in stores, it's important. The boutique honey can be very expensive, but it's worth every penny you spend, because it's unprocessed and natural. What they do for commercially produced honey, so you have Sioux Bee or the Orange Blossom, that honey has been heated up above 160 degrees. It changes the molecular structure of the sugar molecule, and it retards crystallization. So it has longer shelf life. Also, at the same time, because it's warm when they heat this up, they can push it through a filter, and they take out all the good parts, which is the pollen. And that's inside of the honey that floats around inside, which the honey is what the bees live on. We think bees live on honey. Well, they use the honey for carbohydrates, but like all of us, they need amino acids. They need vitamins, minerals, trace elements. That comes from the pollen. That's why it's nutritious eating pollen. Some people spoon it onto the cereal in the morning. You can buy bee pollen in the health food stores. But primarily, natural honey has, when I produce the honey at Glenwood, all we do is decap it. I use a screen that will keep out bee parts or wax, and the pollen goes through, and we sell our honey in a jar that's somewhat has a little bit of a cloud to it, and that's because it's loaded with pollen, which is the best part and the nutritious part of honey, which really what you should eat. That also coincides with a lot of people feel that if they eat local honey, they can reduce their spring allergies. It seems to work. When I was at SUNY Farmingdale, I wanted to do a grant and do the project and evaluate that, but it got turned down because they were worried about people having allergic reactions with the pollen, which really didn't make any sense, but sometimes it's you can't educate people.
It's like what comes first, like the cart or the horse.
Right.
Well, obviously tons more honey talk to be had, which is why I'm so happy we're going to be able to have you back to do a second part of this honey series. Unfortunately, today we are out of time. So we're going to ask folks to hold tight with your honey questions. In the meantime, if you want to tweet us or shoot us an email, it's Aaron_Fairbanks or Aaron@HeritageRadioNetwork. And Rodney is going to be coming back a little bit later in the month to kind of continue the honey conversation. But I feel like we made some good progress today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.
This has been another episode of the Farm Report. You can find this, like all 39 of our weekly shows, for free. Download via iTunes or Stitcher Smart Radio. We are, of course, in the middle of our very first Kickstarter campaign. The goal is to bring you a brand new website so that when you visit www.heritageradionetwork.org, you're not confused and overwhelmed by choices, but delighted with the array of great food, drink, and agriculture talk at your fingertips. So please consider becoming a backer of our Kickstarter campaign today or sometime before May 12th when the campaign ends. And for more information, just visit that website. Thank you so much for tuning in and keep on listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.